Hello from Nashville. This is the Disaster Podcast here at the EMS World Expo, and we thank Physio Control for this wonderful place to have these great discussions. And this is going to be the best podcast ever.
Ever.
And we're actually celebrating a year, aren't we, guys?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are, because it was this time last year that we started talking about this, and Paragon Medical, these two right here, decided, wow, you know, there isn't enough out there on disaster medicine, and maybe we need to talk about that. So we'll talk more about that. And I have the best panel ever. I have my usual favorite two guys, Jim Logan. He can tell you more about himself, Dr. Joe Holly, and my other longtime friend. See, my two favorite disaster docs in a sandwich right here. It just doesn't get better than this.
Disaster sandwich.
Disaster sandwich. Yeah. Exactly. Wow. I'm not going to go any further with that.
Please don't.
Dr. Brian Froelke, and he can tell you about him. And these two have some unique things in common. They're not only both disaster doctors, they're ER docs, but they don't just talk about it, they do it. DMAT and USAR, they get their hands on, and they really appreciate what it's like to be in the trenches as well, which is a unique skill set. We talked about the fact that not even all states have medical directors, so they can speak to the state level, and disaster preparedness, of course, is what Jim does, so it's going to be fun. So tell them about yourself.
My name is Dr. Brian Froelke, and I'm the EMS medical director for a local agency, Christian Hospital EMS, and the state disaster medical director for the state of Missouri, as well as the Missouri State EMS medical director. So, a few different hats.
Busy guy, yeah. Yes. I should probably mention I'm Sam Bradley, in case none of you know me, but I'm not important. Joe?
Joe Holly. I'm an emergency physician and with Tennessee Task Force 1 USAR, but also EMS medical director for City of Memphis and all the surrounding EMS systems in that area, as well as the state of Tennessee EMS medical director. So I have two state level guys here today.
And thank you for the cold weather.
You're most welcome.
You could have worked that out later.
I tried. It came from Missouri, so it's their fault.
It's our fault.
Okay.
Wow.
And Jim.
So I'm not a doctor, but I did stay at the Holiday Inn Express down the road.
That works,
last
yes.
night, so it works. So Jim Logan, I am an emergency manager, disaster planner for the City of Memphis. Have experience with Tennessee Task Force 1, Urban Search and Rescue. And most importantly for this discussion, I am co-founder for Paragon Medical Education Group.
And we'll talk more about that. And we'd like to start our show with a hot topic, and there's little that's hotter right now than the Ferguson episode, which Brian wants to talk to us a little bit about.
Sure.
On that response.
Sure. So, as folks might know, that Christian Hospital EMS is the primary service provider for the Ferguson area for medical response. And so it's all kinds of interesting things from the event. Both from the medical director as well as from the system perspective. And I know one of my colleagues got a chance to talk a little bit about some of the system perspective things. From a disaster preparedness perspective, one of the things that I noticed from that particular event is it fit somewhat under a model similar to a no-notice event like a tornado. We didn't really see anything coming, but and a lot of the event was playing catch-up and trying to scramble to bring the resources to bear based upon the models that we had to what was needed. But it was and then there's always the possibility of any additional types of events related to that initial Ferguson event that we are also in the process of preparing for. Thinking about those potential events more like a hurricane, we can kind of see that there's one on the horizon. We know that there might be one coming down, bearing down on us. We don't know exactly where it's going to hit or to what degree it might be, but we can sort of pre-deploy some assets in anticipation. So going from a no-notice to a little bit more of a preparation is an interesting transition, and learning some of the things that we had from the initial event and trying to gauge our pre-deployment based upon that has also been a challenge.
And Joe, you mentioned to me earlier that even other states, I mean, have to prepare for this kind of thing. So preparedness is kind of our mantra right now. Mm-hmm. But as much as we know, okay, we're not going to have a tornado in California probably, although you will have some earthquakes in the Midwest, we know that. But there's certain things you know you can prepare for. But when you're talking about hostile MCIs or active shooters or that kind of thing, I mean, that could happen virtually anywhere. I mean, who would have thought it would happen in a little burg like Ferguson? So what do you do? Preparedness, you said something about your state even looking at.
Well, certainly Tennessee has been, you know, actively involved with, you know, the E word, Ebola, quite a bit, like everybody has. Sorry, had to say that, as I'm sure everybody has. But, you know, that preparedness level, things are so much more, I hate to use the word universal, but I think, you know, the concerns over social media and all that sort of stuff and how fast information travels and how quick people can respond to events outside their own area where they live via the internet, et cetera. So, you know, part of that preparation, I think, is looking at what might the electronic repercussions be of an event that occurs someplace, whether that's a, you know, a copycat event of an active shooter or, you know, something along the lines of a natural disaster occurring someplace, and that information flowing so much more quickly now than it used to makes for a real challenge, I think, for states especially to try to ramp up and be ready to handle that with the expectation of the public now being so much higher because they got the alert as fast as you did, and they think something needs to be done right now, and it just takes a while to crank those logistics up and get things going. So it's a huge challenge, and Jim certainly spends most of his time now dealing with those fun issues like that.
Right.
Well, I want to talk more about the state level preparedness, but Jim, you know, you're a medic like me and boots on the ground kind of guy. How do you, when you have EMS people going into something like this, which is not going to be anything they ever expected, what are kind of your guidelines and what you do, what you don't know? What are those issues that you look at in emergency management to say what's okay, what's not okay? What are we prepared for? What are we not prepared for?
Well, I think it's like the doc was saying, in Ferguson, at first it was a spin up, and now we can see the storm coming. So there's been a lot of preparedness efforts on the local levels. I can tell you from my area, we've been meeting quite frequently about plans, reviewing. You know, civil unrest doesn't happen all the time in this country, thank goodness. Is it a disaster? Can be, right? It can turn into those mass casualty incidents. So I think it's important for people to, if they're not looking at those plans, because the decision on this indictment is to be announced, I believe, very shortly. We're reviewing plans, making sure that our plans aren't in silos. That's very important, that we share the information with our plans, that we have law enforcement, EMS, and fire, and those plans somehow mesh together. And if they don't, as we review before the storm comes, we find those places where they don't mesh, and we put it together, and we absolutely, positively have to focus on unified command. And having casualty collection points, those types of things that medics and fire and law aren't used to working under casualty collection points in that austere environment, if you will.
Well, and that's an interesting, you know, that's a whole different topic, but we've talked a lot about active shooter, and I know in my area we're doing a lot of training, and there's always something good that comes out of something bad, and one of those good things is that the law enforcement and EMS are actually, and fire, are always actually starting to train together. Yeah. And they recognize the benefit, they recognize the effectiveness, they recognize the safety issues behind doing that. And I think that's a really good thing that's starting to happen.
Well, we as an EMS industry, I think it's starting to happen, but we have to continue to push the effort, push. I think we have to be the leader in that. Okay, because we're all, you know, when we get to a scene, most of the time we're all somewhere else, but we've got to pull it together and say we got to do unified command.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, without question.
Have you seen anything in particular out of the Ferguson experience that sort of surprised you in regards to what Jim was just talking about there?
It takes an awful lot to surprise me.
This is true. Yes.
Well said.
You know, the concept of the unified command, it was actually part of it was surprisingly how well some of the things worked. So many times we talk about the problems with communication and some of the things that balls that are dropped along the way with some of that integration, and to see some of the things working well was not necessarily bad surprising, but kind of nice to see. Some of the preparation that we had from some of our previous exercises and so forth, I saw it implemented in this event. And while it took a little while to spin things up here and there and get some of the kinks worked out, ultimately we had a machine that was working relatively well.
Good.
So the follow-on question to that is the take-home messages from that, and for people like you and I who are in positions with the state and have very broad responsibilities across a very large area, how do you then sort of take the stuff you saw work really well and push that back out to the other parts of Missouri and for me Tennessee that didn't experience that directly and can use those as educational experiences for their own local jurisdictions?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're doing is, as all the disasters start local, one of the things that we're looking at is the EMS responders who are providing medical care, and looking at that, what they all basically carry the protocols that they work normally under with them. But at some point, those protocols might not have certain key pieces of information that they need to work under for an event, such as if they're put in a position where they're working for rehab or force protection. If the environment that they're so used to, we burn into these EMS folks' brains, is the scene safe and do I have all the help I need? What if the answer to those questions is no? Where do you go from there? And having some of the protocols such as the TECC initiative, where you have some answers about indirect and direct threats. And we have a lot of models out there that can be helpful, trying to push those out and using this as a topic that everybody is looking at and helping that become a bridge to some of these resources for folks that people have already done a lot of work on these. It was about a month before this Ferguson event that I implemented that indirect and direct threat piece into our protocols. Mm-hmm. And so while a month might not necessarily have been long enough for it to truly saturate, it was great that it was in there. And you better believe that all the rest of the EMS folks know those protocols now in anticipation of any further event. So it... The other piece of it, which is interesting, is as we start to modify what we need to practice in order to meet the event needs, is who is the medical authority over which under which that occurs. And having some of these discussions ahead of time, at what point does the local medical control exceed what it's, that individual or agency is capable of achieving, and at what point do you move in the unified command to more of a branch structure where you have somebody else who helped coordinate medical assets, and who is the medical director or the MD or whoever needs to be behind what medicine is being practiced in an environment. Mm-hmm. And so we're working to try to help connect some of those dots. And it starts at the local level, but ultimately, for some of these events, especially when you have National Guard deployed and other sort of state assets or Missouri Disaster Medical Response System that has the capability of providing some state resources, who's the ultimate medical authority that, and how does that shift and transfer that authority? Is a work in progress.
No doubt. And then you take that to the next level of when you and I's jurisdictions both experienced the big earthquake of the New Madrid Fault. How are states and feds going to work together, to continue those practices, et cetera? We talked a little bit offline about the state EMS officials organization, which is exactly what it says, but it's like data managers, EMS directors, and EMS medical directors. And the EMS medical directors from the states that have EMS medical directors get together a couple times a year in a big council and have a whole agenda of items that we cover. This is almost always on the agenda of these cross-border issues and trying to work together and how do we get things working together at the state level as well as our federal partners that are going to come in behind that, and then the local jurisdictions that are actually out in front of most of that. So, huge challenge.
And Brian, we've talked a lot about EMAC, and I don't know that a lot of people understand what that is.
Sure.
But say Joe had a big incident in Tennessee and asked you for resources. Explain a little bit about EMAC and how that works.
Yeah, so EMAC is basically an emergency mutual aid compact. and that is basically state-to-state sharing of disaster or emergent resources, where one state can ask for a resource from another state, and it can be transferred directly without having the federal government or national resources be deployed. Mm-hmm. It can occur state-to-state. One of the benefits of that is that you can have identification of assets that might not be in all of the different states. So ahead of time, you can look to the states that have certain resources and plan ahead for when you might ask for those type of resources and set things up ahead of time so that with a stroke of a pen, you can ask for the right resources, know where to get it, and the package can be delivered. So a lot of preparing there, and then a lot of looking around for what resources are around, because there's not a great repository for where all these different state assets are and how to ask for them. It's not an immediately clear database of all of these potential resources to look for. So that part of the preparation of going out and getting involved in these things and figuring out who has what, and sometimes some of these national level exercises where everybody comes out to play across the nation are wonderful opportunities to see what other states have available so that you can ask for them directly if you need them.
Exactly. So give us, and I want both of you to answer this question, but give us a 10,000-foot view. We all know about local control. We know about, all incidents start at the local. We have unified command. Okay, so those resources are exceeded. Then we go regionally, and then we go move up through the state and the federal. So in your state, how would that work from the top, bottom up?
From the bottom up from an event?
You have a big enough event that, we're going to be running out of resources at each level till we get up to the federal level. How does it work in your state? What assets do you have available?
Sure. So in our state, basically local home rule, we have the local control that starts off when they require assistance. Typically, it's mutual aid, whether it be automatic or through request of the services in their surrounding area. As those resources become saturated, then they start looking for other assets. Many times we have things, for example, in the UASC regions or in certain areas, we have grantee regions for certain types of disaster preparedness, and a lot of times those conglomerates, either multiple counties or multiple, sometimes crossing state lines, those organizations get involved with deploying available resources or organizing the regional assets. Once it gets to the point where those are either deploying to the scene or activated, then we start looking at, on the state side of things, what state-based assets are available. And depending on the event, you have the difficult decision of what assets you deploy to the immediate event as it's occurring and how many of those assets need to be retained in case of the next event or secondary type of events, whether it be weather-related or potential civil unrest or whatever the source is. If you send all your eggs in one basket to one place, then they might not be available for the next thing down the road, and how to balance some of those resources. And then at the state level as well, if you've had partnerships with some of your other states and some of the other assets, you start thinking about EMACs. Perfect example. A lot of our Missouri assets are closer in response capability to the southern part of Illinois than coming down from Chicago, but yet it crosses that state border. And so without that invite, without that request for some of the assets put in place ahead of time, there can be some barriers to that response capability if you don't plan ahead.
But you do work very closely with Illinois,
yes.
I believe.
Yeah, we work well with them.
We have friends there. Yeah. And then, of course, we've talked a lot about the federal assets when they're finally deployed. So how does it work in Tennessee, Joe? How would that same scenario?
It's a very similar process in Tennessee. I think that the most states do that process pretty well. Certainly the Emergency Operations Center locally is going to be engaged at the state level. The Tennessee Emergency Management Agency would be involved in that as well as kind of the coordinating group for those requests and sort of where those things are flowing. Whether it be at a local level or ultimately up to even a request for federal assets. So, again, going back to some of the preparation stuff around the current infectious disease threat, we've had a lot of conversation about suddenly the Public Health Service is a big resource that's kind of been pulled into that process, maybe much sort of more so than it has been in the past for a natural disaster type response, et cetera. This is sort of a public health based response. Mm-hmm. And so their processes now are much more integrated in the thought processes and in the resource request piece than they used to be, because literally now the CDC's, you know, to the point of having a emergency response capability to send a, you know, a resource to that hospital to assist, something that they've not thought of before. So the disaster world has now reached into the public health world more so than it has in the past.
Well, what I'm hearing in general is these silos are being broken down locally, regionally, statewide, federally, and maybe they need to be.
No, no doubt.
You know, just like we were talking about, you know, cops and firefighters and EMS people working together. I mean, I think that and I think the way of the world is kind of forcing that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a state-level team that you could deploy like Missouri does?
There are state-level assets that can be deployed. I think, for example, in the urban search and rescue world, you know, we're a federal asset that is located in Memphis, but we certainly can be activated and have been activated at a state level and to be utilized as a state-level resource. A lot of those things sort of cross the border between either being state, local, federal, regional, et cetera. Some of the other teams that have been pulled together for Tennessee have actually been regional teams where individual components of the team might be made up of different counties' capabilities. And as opposed to reproducing the hazmat capability in three different counties, you simply let one county focus on that. Another county does the search and rescue piece, another county does the medical piece, and then when something happens, you pull those assets together and send that team. So it works for a regional area without overburdening counties whose budgets are limited and personnel are limited.
Yeah. So Jim, at your level, in a disaster, would you be the person or would it be your agency that looks for assets and requests assets? What do you do at your level?
Where I'm at currently as the emergency manager for the city, we would work if we had an event within our capabilities, just like Dr. Folks was saying, and then we would move up to the county level, and then state, and then federal. But I think bringing it back to the Ferguson, right, incident, I don't think it'd be any need for urban search and rescue. I think we'd go back to the EMAC, right? EMACs, and strike teams would be required. So I think the key point there is that not predict, but have the possibility of a Ferguson verdict or decision being given down in this case, and then there being just the way it is, activists planted in different places across the United States and have an incident in Memphis as well. So we couldn't really send assets to Ferguson as strike teams because we were being affected as well, right? So that's the beauty of an EMAC, is that it's a handshake agreement. It's not a mandate of any type. For instance, if we had the New Madrid, right, we moved from Ferguson to an earthquake, right? That's exactly right, because we would be affected just like you would, and we couldn't send each other assets, but we could reach out to New Mexico or Illinois or somewhere else to get those assets pulled down. But that's got to be coordinated at the state level. So back to your question, it's local, county, state.
Right.
Governor has to make a request to FEMA
that's
and
right.
the president for all this Stafford
federal
Act,
activation.
Right, for
yes.
federal activation. If it's not done, you have a New Orleans and a Katrina. And that's mm-hmm. so the Stafford Act has to be followed. There
exactly.
has to be those trigger points or those tipping points to make that next notification. So, but it's all taking yourself out of those silos and having that good line of communication.
And those larger disasters utilize pretty much everybody and everything mm-hmm. that's out there. Mm-hmm. So, Brian, talk a little bit about your state deployment to the Joplin tornado. I was a little bit involved.
Yeah, so let's see. So the Joplin tornado, that was another one of those no-notice events. We have some disaster capabilities. The first thing we did is send off an immediate response from our state assets rapid response team, 8-person unit. But we knew that that wasn't going to be enough. That just has that most rapid capability. We also ended up bringing our 35-bed DMAT-like emergency department to that event and deployed that, set it up, and started treating patients. And then we deployed our mobile medical unit, which is a 60-bed hospital as well in the parking lot of the trauma center that was damaged. And we started helping to take care of both the victims as well as the standard folks that would come through any hospital, emergency department, and hospital system. So we had multiple tiers that we deployed to that. Both the immediate response as well as something that took close to a week or so to build and to establish and longer term, and everything in between. So
how many?
In a nutshell.
Yeah, very much. How many people do you think were engaged in that state level deployment?
Oh, goodness.
That's a tough question, probably.
No idea.
All of them?
Yeah, all of them.
All of them.
Now, one thing that was interesting is out of some of that event, our disaster medical group, our Missouri Disaster Medical Response System, actually it now incorporates the disaster mortuary assets for the, and the funeral director assets for our state. We've sort of merged some of those because of that combination of medical response as well as mortuary response being key ties. So another set of silos that we were able to break down and lessons learned from
Excellent.
That event.
How about the veterinary side?
Good point.
Yes,
good point.
Yes.
Also huge.
Yes.
It is huge. And I think a lot of states are modeling after the feds because they have all those assets. They have the DMORTs. They have the veterinary teams and, of course, the medical teams. They even have specialized nursing teams. They have specialized surgical teams. We saw that in Haiti. Jim, you look like
so,
you have a...
Yeah, so we're even setting up, you know, with the Humane Societies that if we have a need for sheltering, we have a shelter that's near... Right, for people with pets, that they're almost co-located, not together, but we're very, very close where they could go visit their pets if they needed shelter.
That's important.
Well, sometimes you can't keep you can't get people to leave their home.
Exactly. I'd
if
be one
if
of
you
them.
Can't take right, if you can't take your pets to a shelter, you're not going. But if you say, yeah, you can take it, we'll take care of that. And so that's a consideration. Like yesterday we were talking about, you know, special needs, functional needs. That just fits one of those other categories.
And that was a big issue in Katrina because when these people lost everything but all they had was their little dog, you weren't going to get them on an aircraft and evacuate them if that dog didn't go. And that became a huge issue.
Yep.
But, you know, when you're talking about people care, that's a really important issue. Sometimes you just have to stretch those rules and make sure you take care of people. So... You guys, again, are unique because you're DMAT doc and USAR doc. And I don't know, Brian, have you been on federal deployments? Is it in your federal role?
I have to a number of different hurricanes. Haven't in the recent past. So a number of my colleagues are, but as some of my other hats grow larger, I become less available for some of the other options
that
I've done.
Yeah, you have to kind of triage those things, don't you? Yeah.
Yes.
Good point.
But many opportunities out there. A number of my colleagues have gotten a chance to go to any number of federal types of deployments, everything from vaccination programs and things that we had not really thought of, using, NDMS personnel for and HHS and that whole place.
We'll have to define all these acronyms later.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Alphabet soup
Jamie
coming out of my mouth.
Jamie always catches me on the acronyms, but we'll give you a dictionary.
Yeah.
How many DMATs are in Missouri? Just the one?
So we have one state-based disaster medical response system, MO1 DMAT Incorporated, and we have the federal disaster medical assistance team that's the federal asset. So we have them both. And then we also, our state assets are regionalized. So we have pockets of key capabilities in areas around the state. So it's not all in one location.
Yeah, California is rather unique in that respect because we have six of them. We have six teams across the state. In fact, when my team got started around 1996, it was right after some of the earthquakes occurred up there. Of course, Loma Prieta in 1989, I realized there's a whole pocket of them in Southern California and then nothing between there and Oregon, I guess. And it's like, well, wait a minute. We have a few things that happen around San Francisco occasionally, buildings falling down and that kind of thing. So we started establishing the Bay Area team followed by the Sacramento team. How many do you have in Tennessee?
There's one federal DMAT in Tennessee located in Chattanooga, and then the USAR team is located in Memphis.
Well, Joe, talk a bit about USARs and how they integrate with DMATs and other federal assets, and what do you guys do? And maybe we can kind of, we haven't done this for a while, let's kind of look at what DMATs do and what USARs do.
Sure. Well, the USAR function is search and rescue, so it's sort of going out into the area that's affected and seeking out victims who are trapped, injured, or haven't been, you know, accounted for yet. And ultimately then getting them out of that situation, treating whatever medical conditions are happening, and then sort of moving them along to the right chain, as it were, if they need evacuation, et cetera, or ultimately to higher level medical care, depending on sort of where that is. In many cases, that may be located very far away. In many cases, that's a DMAT that's set up in a parking lot someplace that becomes our resource for those additional medical issues that we need, and how we can get that patient ultimately, sort of through a DMAT, and then from a DMAT through an evacuation point, and out of the area completely. And that's really challenging with special needs patients, with folks who are in hospitals and require mechanical support of some sort, whether that's something like a ventilator or just home oxygen and things like that. But all of those things come into play in the resources that are required to not only get them out of the damaged environment, but where do they end up once they're removed from that situation? Disasters, rarely occur when it's sunny and 72 degrees outside. So there's environmental issues and power, electricity to support their machinery and people and transportation. I mean, all those issues come into play. So, I think the interaction between DMAT and USAR is a very powerful one, because they're both sort of federal level assets, and they integrate together very nicely to continue the patient sort of flowing through the system, as it were, and that NDMS, is a nationwide response capability. So there are NDMS basic hospitals that allow a patient to, flow through the federal side all the way to where they're going to end up, back inside
a lot of people
facility,
don't realize that. An NDMS hospital is one that's made an agreement with the federal government that they will take patients. That's the next step. So when we're in our DMAT environment, and you're familiar with JPATS, more acronym, sorry, I don't want to bore you with all these explanations, but they're the people that when they're done at the DMAT, USAR's done, and they have to be transported to wherever they're going to go, their hospital stay. That is when a different branch of the federal government takes over and gets those people's place in a facility, and they are basically watched until they are completed. I mean, that their case stays open until they actually get home again. So we can sometimes release people locally, and then sometimes we have to keep them in our system a while longer. So as a DMAT doc, Joe, what have you learned? What are some adventures that you've had? And I think you've had quite a few, actually.
Are you talking about on the USAR side?
On the USAR side.
Oh, yeah, lots.
As a USAR doctor.
Lots and lots.
What are some of your most memorable?
Well, obviously Katrina was a big one. Jim and I were both at the Pentagon for 9/11. And spent a couple of weeks there. Lots of hurricane deployments. I think our team's been involved in some really unusual things, like searching for the shuttle astronauts after the shuttle disaster.
Oh, really?
Yeah, some of the elements of the team were involved in that search function, so kind of unusual for sure. Help me here, Jim. What else?
I think one thing that comes to mind is that the just Missouri and Tennessee, we were the first two urban search and rescue teams to set foot in New Orleans after the hurricane.
Oh, really?
And so one of the unique things that I was just thinking about when you guys were talking was sometimes it becomes a disaster within a disaster. And so we've got to, taking care of our own becomes an issue. And so really quick, the Zephyr Field, where we all started, was two teams, Missouri and Tennessee. Then it grew from the teams from California within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so at about day two, there was about 2,500 rescuers right inside a given area. So we were given the medical mission by a command, by FEMA, to set up a mobile hospital. We were donated a mobile mammography van, believe it or not, and we operated a clinic. As a matter of fact, Lynn Thompson was standing out here just a second ago. We helped manage that. And so we saw people from because we couldn't send them to the DMAT because those guys were just beat up with what was going on with the citizens, right? And so we had to establish our own city within a city, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of some of the unique stuff that mm-hmm. You're not expecting to do that. You're expecting to go out and take care of the masses, not take care of yourself. So we had to split up and divide and conquer and take care of the people inside the camp, if you will, and people in New Orleans.
So it shows that, you know, as much as there is a pattern to how things are done and certain permissions have to be gained and all of this, there has to be some flexibility. Mm. I mean, you SAR guys are used to digging in trenches for people and pulling in. We talked about one that you had where I guess there was a collapse of a structure and you had to cut through the ceiling to get into somebody's bedroom. And that's the kind of thing you expect to do, but you never know. It might be something completely different.
Yep.
But I think because DMAT, Disaster Medical Assistance Team, thank you. We're a group of medical people from EMTs on up through every level in our job, and we might have 50 strong deploying into an area. And the whole idea is when there's lots of patients, there's people who are displaced from their homes, and basically, and one big factor is the local healthcare infrastructure damaged or dead? In the case of Katrina, there was basically nothing left. So we are the only medical care those people may get. In other cases, you may have a situation where there is damage, where you augment that facility. In other cases, it's just a fact of the capacity is just too large. It's a surge capacity. We could take a tent out and triage people coming in. So the folks that need ER care, we're going to make sure those folks get into the hospital, but not necessarily everybody that doesn't need to be in an ER. So there's all of these different configurations. I'm hearing. I'm less familiar with the USAR side, but I'm curious about how much medicine you guys do when your primary role is really to find people and to do some immediate care and then pass them off to a DMAT or whatever else.
Well, we're really the so our mission, real first mission, is to take care of our team medically, and then take care of, including canine, right, and search dogs. They're our team members as well, so we have training in that. And then secondly, to take care of the victims that are found. So that's really it. So I think there's four that travel in a heavy team, and sometimes that's just not enough. When you have big events like that. But that's kind of our mission, theoretically. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk about it.
And from the urban search and rescue side of things, I also had the opportunity of doing some training with our search and rescue team in Missouri. And from a medical perspective, it's interesting practicing medicine on folks who are entrapped or practicing medicine on folks who are in confined spaces and so forth. There's also some of the medicine at a distance. And so a lot of unique skill sets that come along with the USAR teams that can be applied either to the team members or the victims, depending on how. But just a unique set of skills that are important to recognize, and when you need them, know where they are.
Exactly. I'm just kind of envisioning this scenario where you're the DMAT doc and he's the USAR doc, and we're talking about medical control. How does it work at that level?
Well, that's a good question. I think it turns out to be a handshake agreement most of the time. So for the USAR side, obviously the medical control comes from the USAR physician who's engaged there. But at some point, you know, we're a conduit. That patient is going to move through us to some other facility, and that handoff is going to occur just like it would occur with any patient anywhere, where I'm going to reach out to, you know, a DMAT if that's where we're headed. I'm going to have a conversation with the doc there. I'm going to make certain, here's what I got. Do you have the capability of taking care of it? Do I need to try to find something else? Does the patient need to go someplace else? You know, here's what we've done. Here's what we think it's going to need. And ensuring that that's the right place for the patient to be, and it's not going to overwhelm their resources, and that they're the right option for that patient. And then, you know, a transfer of that patient to their care, like what happened rolling in the ED, any place in the country, I think.
So it is entirely conceivable someday the two of you may be out there working in the same environment.
Yeah, but absolutely. Probably
Jim,
already have at some point. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. Now you know each other better. But Jim touched on something I think is important, and we've touched on it in other podcasts, and that's taking care of our own. And Chris had a podcast earlier that I was really touched by, and I totally agree with this point in terms of mental health and the fact that we don't take care of our field people enough. We're not as situationally aware of when things are going south, and that That's something to me that's critically important. I did a lot of CISM over the years for EMS and firefighters, and I saw a lot of people slip through the cracks. So now you have a situation where your providers are in a worst-case scenario. They may be new to disaster medicine, and the first thing they do is get thrown into the middle of a Katrina-like situation. They didn't really know what they were getting into. Of course, on the federal side, we make sure we train them to understand those expectations. Those 5 years of training before they even get to their first event, if they last that long and don't get bored and go away. But so now you not only have your people that you have to take care of physically and mentally, and we've talked a lot about the crud that you get just being in these environments and so forth, but now you have patients who not only have illnesses and injuries, their whole family, the last time they saw them, they were heading downriver, and they don't know where they are. I mean, how do we as disaster workers come home with our faculties intact, knowing that what we've seen and what we've done? And the other thing, too, is when you're in your ERs, and I'm in the field, and Jim's doing what he's doing, we usually have some level of closure. We take these people to the hospital. We turn them over to somebody and say, hey, this will have a good ending because I know Brian will take care of them. We don't have that. We don't have that in disaster med. And how do we handle that, Brian?
So I'm so happy you bring up mental health. My wife's a social worker, so I'm
there
a little biased.
Yeah.
But I think there's two critical pieces. There's the mental health for the providers who are providing the support, as well as the mental health of the communities who are engaged in the disaster, and recognizing that early recognition of those mental health needs is important, both for the appropriate requests for those services, as well as the long-term monitoring and management, because we all tend to focus on the immediate needs and the readily visible needs. You know, this bone is broken, I need to fix it. But what we don't necessarily see is the mental impact until we have the opportunity to decompress a little, take it home, have a couple of meals with the family or the team, and then those sorts of underlying undercurrents start to come out. And recognizing that that's going to happen and how to address those issues ahead of time is important.
Well, and one thing I learned is you, when you're in a work mode, and it's hard to explain what that is, you guys understand what I'm talking about, and God bless the people at Ground Zero, but they tried to do a debriefing, the formal debriefing on a room of 200 people going home. It didn't work real well, because that's a situation where you have a very formalized process. You need to go through different steps, and each person has to have the ability to get some feedback on that, and it doesn't really happen with that many people. That has to happen after we're home. Like you said, you're home, you're diffusing, you're getting some time with the family. Then you can let the shields down and really talk about it. But we have to be able to, taking care of those people in the field. And I wish we had time to have more discussion on this, because I know it's critically important.
Absolutely. Well, I think Brian touched on it. Those are not visible injuries. They're not apparent injuries.
Exactly.
And it takes work to investigate enough to know if something's going on there, and that's a challenging thing to do. It takes investment in time and effort, as opposed to going, wow, your arm looks broken, let's go take care of that.
That's easy.
Those are easy. So those are the hard things to fix, and I think it's hard to get people to dedicate the resources necessary to, just in time and energy, to evaluate, identify, and then do something about them.
But I think my fire chief retired last week, and one of his famous phrases is, take care of each other. And I think that really says it right there, is we got to always look out for everybody that we're with, because you're going to notice those subtle signs, maybe that somebody is overworked, they need downtime, whatever it may be. And just, would you agree, Jim?
Yeah, I think having good docs on teams like that can tell, leaders that can tell their, because you know, traditionally, in our business, we don't like to admit things like that or tell on each other, if you will. But having a leader that's outside of our circle that can say, hey, look, guys, the experienced guys, these are things I want you to be looking out for. Because when we go to these disasters, we tend to leave a little piece of ourselves there at that location.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and it's just having good leaders to start that mental health healing process. You know, to identify that kind of thing.
Well, they're going to throw us out of here. Right. I wish we had another hour. We could certainly keep going. But
we can keep going.
Where do they find out more about you and your teams and mention. All the stuff you're
so,
interested in.
So you can visit, for the disaster hat, you can visit www.modrs.org, which is the disaster team, or you can reach me always at my academic hat, Washington University, through froelkeb at wusm.wustl.edu.
Jamie will put those in the...
hopefully that'll all be like... Yeah. Oh, no.
Joe Hawley, your name is easier.
My name is much easier.
Where do we find... And we didn't get a chance to talk about your wonderful training and education.
Well, I think we did. That's where all of our training comes from, is all those experiences.
Well, there you go.
And, about,
and I would have loved to have more time to talk about the training aspect of this, but
yeah,
that's another podcast.
We draw it from all
those. Where do they find Paragon? Where do they find you?
Well,
guys?
Paragon's on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, and you can also find us on Facebook under the same handle, and our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
And where do they find Jim Logan?
Same place.
Same place.
Same place.
All right. And I'm Sam Bradley, and unfortunately we have to wrap this up. We really appreciate Physio-Control giving us this opportunity to have this wonderful, these wonderful conversations and these great people up here. I'm Sam Bradley. You can find me at the usual social media places under that name, SamBradley11 on Twitter, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And please come up to the site. Here we are in video for you, but ask your questions. Any one of these folks, if you have a specific question about DMED or USAR or state teams or whatever it might be, please ask those questions, and I'm sure any of these great guys would be more than willing to give you answers. And for those states that don't have teams yet, Brian can even tell you how to start one. So I wish we could have had that conversation. So, disaster medicine, the last words on that. Disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.